vision. Your paradigm is about to shift at the intersection of fact and reason. You're entering Kingston Country.
I'm Dan Kingston, and you're listening to the Dan Kingston Podcast.
Joining the podcast again today, Marine combat veteran Sergeant Trey Bearclaw works at a hospital in radiology and cardiology intervention, also former Army combat medic in addition to the Marines. Welcome back on the podcast, Sergeant.
Awesome. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you being here because you have firsthand information. You work at a hospital. Your partner works at a hospital. You have friends that work in hospitals. And Florida now has over 1,400 cases. You told me privately, I hope it's okay to share, that you've witnessed that some people that may need to be tested are not being tested, that you're seeing that. Is that fair? What's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. So there seems to be some sort of a disconnect between what the President of the United States and his administration and Dr. Fauci is saying and what's actually going on in the hospitals. Now, there are some patients that are being tested under certain circumstances, but the guidelines that they're testing by are based on facility, and they're really strict. So rather than get into the handful of patients that we're testing, I would like to talk about the probably hundreds, if not thousands, of patients that should be being tested but are not. And, of course, there's an array of excuses. So at my hospital particularly that I work at, we had a patient. Now, we have had zero patients at my hospital test positive for the coronavirus. Zero. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't taken care of patients that had coronavirus-like symptoms. But my hospital touts that we have zero coronavirus patients at the hospital, which is true if you overlook the fact that patients were not tested when we asked for them to be tested and were life-flighted, because my hospital is not the highest acuity hospital in the area. So we've had patients that have been either transported to other hospitals for ECMO, or we've had patients life-flighted to other hospitals to be put in higher acuity ICUs, who then later on have tested positive for the coronavirus.
So it's possible you've been exposed to it personally.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. You know, and as we talked in private before we started this podcast, my girlfriend works at a local hospital, and they are currently treating known positive cases of coronavirus. So she more than likely has been come in contact with it. And we could talk about, you know, people that are, you know, who've probably had contact with patients who have it, who are asymptomatic, you know, here in a little bit. But
we just don't know. We don't know the numbers because we don't have the testing that would be necessary in order to quarantine the people that are positive. Now, let's get into specifics. The patient that you mentioned tested negative for basically everything else. You said they're being tested for, and so you know, it would make sense, I guess, in that case to try to test for coronavirus, right? Because they tested everything else, but that didn't happen. And then the healthcare worker is caring for that person got sick as well. Is that true?
Yes.
And were they tested?
To my knowledge, at this point, no, they have not been.
Are they staying home or are they going to work?
They were admitted to another facility's ICU.
Oh, my. So they got really sick.
Yes.
Oh my goodness!
So we are on the front lines of a pandemic, where the guidelines coming down. You hear the president and the administration saying anyone who wants to be tested can be tested.
Right.
Well, that in fact is not the case.
No. It's not. I mean, I just know from relatives, okay, not working in hospitals, but just having family members in California that have symptoms and they can't get tested. And I don't really know it. If you're not seriously ill, you shouldn't really stand in line and wait to get tested anyway, right?
Right. Now, that's correct. That's correct. But some of the cases that we're talking about, now, one of the local hospitals has a 90-minute turnaround time for coronavirus testing, which is some of the fastest, I think, in our area.
Yeah.
We have some pretty good hospitals here in Northwest Florida as far as laboratory testing and stuff like that goes. And they've got their turnaround times down to about 90 minutes. One of the issues that you have is when you ask for a test and they say, well, we can't because the state labs are backloaded and we're not going to get the results anytime soon. Then the request is made, well, what about a private lab? And you're getting comments like, well, I'm not paying for that. Now, this is hospital administrators who don't want to pay for the test at a private lab. So you have extremely sick patients. You have first responders in our area who are sick, who are trying to be treated, who are extremely sick, who have other family members who are first responders in the household and with other underlying pre-existing conditions, and they're not able to get tested.
Now, Trey, I got to stop you because now people maybe have heard you on this podcast, know where you're coming from. Others may not. You tend to be supportive of this president and American First policies. And you've also tended to not be one of these fearmongers about coronavirus in the past. If anything, you've kind of been like, you know, this is being overhyped, overblown. So what you're saying now, it's kind of evolution, I would say. I mean, you're seeing people being affected by this in a big way. Has it changed your thinking in terms of the seriousness of coronavirus or just in terms of what's happening in the hospitals? I mean, how has your thinking evolved on coronavirus?
Right. Well, absolutely. So it has definitely evolved. And I think when you're on the front lines in healthcare and you're seeing things kind of rapidly deteriorate at a pretty quick pace, and policies and procedures and protocol are either one, not being followed, or two, getting in the way of treatment and diagnosis, it becomes an issue. And I think that part of the thing is economy. Part of the thing is people's health. I mean, it all ties together.
Like a balancing act. How do you protect health? Yeah. How do you protect the economy? How do you protect civil liberties?
You cannot have one without the other of all three of those things.
Right.
Right? Appropriate health care, a good economy, and civil liberties without having all three are in combination. If once one goes, the others are quick to follow.
It's true.
And if you're trying to flatten the curve, which we've heard a lot about, and if you're trying to keep the economy going and get people back to work as quick as possible, then I think that you need to have a by any means necessary type approach when it comes to treatments in healthcare, whether that's using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin off-label, or whether that's making sure that we have rapid tests or laboratory tests that have, you know, with just a couple hour turnaround time, and making sure that anybody who needs to be tested can be tested. You know, these drive-up tests are great. We've had those in the area. You know, several hundred people show up to be tested, but no one gets the results because the labs that they're going to are, you know, so far behind. We need rapid tests, and we need laboratory tests with turnaround times quicker than 4 or 5 days.
You know, let me ask you something, because you have firsthand experience, you know, working with you are a medical professional, but you're working with doctors. And I think, you know, frankly, there's a lot of people, including myself, I don't trust doctors. And I get the feeling like doctors, they look at us like flesh and bones. But right now we're being told we need to trust doctors and you know, they're the ones that it's life and death, right? And what's your experience with doctors? Are you impressed with what's happening right now. At one time, you mentioned, you know, the army or the military should be brought in to help. Are the civilian doctors able to handle this?
So, yes and no. One, you should absolutely trust doctors. By and large, and all the ones that I've ever worked with in over a 15-year career, whether it was military doctors or civilian doctors, they are fantastic people with a wealth of knowledge. I consider myself to be a subject matter expert when it comes to healthcare. And part of the reason why is because some of the most genius professionals that I've ever worked with were physicians who took the time to teach me. So, and I owe a lot to them. So I will have to kind of disagree a little bit. Now, there may be some out there, you know, that are more about money and prestige and their status because of being a physician. For sure. There's always going to be that no matter where you go. By and large, 99.9% of physicians, to include all other healthcare providers underneath, are doing it because they feel that they are really helping humanity in a time of crisis, whether it's during a pandemic, whether it's during a normal flu season, or whether it's during a time of trauma, or helping somebody have a higher quality of life managing chronic disease.
So if we were in the like behind the scenes and we could see some of the stuff you're seeing, that it would reflect well on doctors. It would look heroic. It wouldn't look like, you know, scary stuff is going on and they're treating us like flesh and bones. Like, so you're saying I shouldn't be that concerned about that aspect of it, that these really are heroes. The doctors really are heroes.
Right, absolutely.
Okay,
and that's across the board in healthcare, and I don't even point to like trauma surgeons, or with me working with interventional radiologists, interventional cardiologists, and vascular surgeons, where we're doing trauma and acute care and extreme illness and stuff like that. The procedures themselves are for most people to watch are really miraculous stuff that we do these days. Cutting edge. The top of medicine, but I would not even have people look at that. I wish that I could have people in the control room or in a surgical suite with me when I'm having a private conversation about people and health with the physician. And a lot of the things they say, and if you could overhear that conversation, a lot of the things that you would hear would give you the perspective, I believe, that these people are really in it for the healthcare and for the people and doing what's best for the people. Doctors do a lot of things that people don't know about behind the scenes to treat patients that lose money. There are times that we've done procedures on patients that by the time we're at the end, the cost of the procedure, because of the supplies or the, some of the stuff that we used, far exceeds any reimbursement that the physician or the facility is going to get. They make some good money on some of the procedures, but then there's others that they lose money on. So it's a balancing act, in healthcare, just like it is running any other type of business.
So it's the administrators then, it sounds like they're the ones getting in the way, the hospital administrators that say, no, it's too expensive for this private test, when nurses and doctors should be getting tested, right? If they're dealing with sick patients, you'd hope that they're getting tested because you're on the front lines. You guys are.
Some of the blame, because there are times, look, if it was up to me and the doctors that I worked with, we would run a huge bill up and we would probably not be able to treat patients for more than 6 months because we're going to do what we got to do with what we have to do it with. It's up to the administrators to come up with policies and procedures to help keep us in line, right? Or we would be bankrupt and not be able to treat anyone. So having the split between healthcare and administrators is needed. So don't get me wrong when I say that there's issues there, but it's usually in situations like this where there's a pandemic where we need to be able to go ahead and say, you know what, like Governor Cuomo in New York, who I have to give a lot of credit to in his leadership over the last couple of weeks, and I'm not a fan of the governor of New York. In his statement on TV earlier today, said it doesn't matter what the cost is going to be, that we're not putting a cost on a human life. You know, he talked about his mom. He talked about other people's moms and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and stuff like that. And that's the type of mentality that you need to have here. And it's not just hospital administrators. I'm going to not put all the blame on them. It's down the line through the FDA, through the CDC, through the State Department of Health, where there's so many guidelines that they're still trying to follow. That exactly what we've said all along. When things are normal and functioning as normal, then these guidelines are just, you know, kind of workarounds that we have to deal with. But in extreme emergencies, or in a case like this where you have a pandemic and you're having to step outside of the box, they have a very hard time doing that.
You're worried that perhaps nurses or medical staff aren't being tested, because if they test positive, now they're going to get paid sick leave, and that hurts the bottom line of the hospital.
Right. So, you know, it's more than just that. I mean, it's if they test positive, now you're down a nurse. Now you're also having to quarantine other professionals in that area that they worked around. And so then you're down a lot of staff.
Are they just not testing because they don't want to find positives?
You know, as tough as it is for me to say, I think that that's kind of what it is. That they want to, they will treat and test when they absolutely have no way around it. But if there's a way to get around doing any type of testing, to me, that's what it seems like they're doing.
So it's more likely, you know, that, and I had this other thought, maybe the president doesn't want that many tests because they don't want it to show that we all have it.
Well, I don't know how far it goes up. Like I said, there is for sure a disconnect between what the president is saying and what is being done. And this is people that I talk to, not just in my area, but throughout the state. Yeah. Or throughout the state, right?
Right.
And, you know, because I've worked in the military, and I have friends in healthcare in other states. I traveled for a little while. So I know people in other states and other facilities that through social media, we still keep in contact, and we've been following each other during this time. So this is across the board. It seems to be a little bit different in New York, because the governor of New York seems to be on the same page with the administration, which is helpful, because where, regardless of what the president says, when the president says we're leaving a lot of this to the states, it's because the states need to deal with it. So the trickle down from the federal government to the state governments down to the hospitals is not what it needs to be. And it's not a failure of our healthcare system, because we're capable of treating what we're seeing, I think, as far as the staff goes. When it comes to everything else, from regulations to appropriate medications being supplied to appropriate personal protective equipment being supplied and having the appropriate regulations in place for us to test these patients, a protocol that we don't deviate from unless we absolutely have to, there's just a disconnect between bureaucrats and healthcare professionals.
And now you have a shelter in place right now, right, in your area?
No, we don't actually. Right now, they want us to try. You know, we're still doing social distancing. Our state has not sheltered in place.
Do you have restaurants are open and bars are open?
We have restaurants and fast food chains that are open, but they are delivery. Pick up through, you know, a drive-through window.
Okay. You can't eat
or something like that. Now, right. So most of the places, as far as I know, you cannot eat in.
What about like a movie theater? Are there like movie theaters open?
you know, I have no idea. Today's been my first day off in a while.
You've been working hard.
I haven't been out. I've either been working or on call, so I haven't got the opportunity to really get around. And I actually work in a hospital two counties over, so I get up and drive 45, 50 minutes to work every morning and then back and then stay over there when I'm on call. So I'm very rarely even at my house. And so I don't really know.
Well,
exactly,
let me ask you, like, let's say
I know grocery stores are still open.
Oh yeah. Thank God. They're open over here too. They shut down the grocery stores. Yeah. That's going to be a real freak out. But what about as a worker in the medical field, professional, and you're seeing what's happening on the ground, would you feel, how would it make you feel if movie theaters were operating normally? And, you know, would that concern you? Do you think that steps should be taken to prevent gatherings, you know, and even at the risk of hurting the economy?
Right. So I think there should be a balance. You know, the statistics don't matter if your family member dies.
Right.
Statistics don't matter if you were on the ventilator.
It's true.
But statistically, this has not even come close. In 2018, 2019 flu season, I worked at an urgent care. I was doing between 35 and 75 flu swabs a day, 85% positive results. And the ones that weren't positive, when they came back for treatment 2 or 3 days later, eventually ended up testing positive. So I think 60 million people were diagnosed with flu during that flu season. 500,000 were hospitalized, and there was somewhere between 30 and 60,000, I can't remember right off the top of my head, deaths from the flu, 2018-29 flu season. So we have the capability of containing this, and we have the capability of treating. What we don't want to do, even though it's still way less than the flu, you don't want to add this to what is still a flu season.
Right. You don't want multiple flus all going around, and you're just like, oh, right. Who knows what flu who right. has? I don't know.
Right. So I think stores that should be open, all the restaurants should stay open, fast food should stay open, grocery stores should stay open, banks can stay open, gas stations, stuff like that. But it should be minimal personnel, and it should be, you know, drive-through only. Movie theaters, bars, such as that, probably should not be open.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%.
It's unfortunate to say because, you know, I feel for the people who during this time are either going to lose a job or not get very much time at work. And hopefully the federal government will hurry up and do what they need to do to help those people out. But for the sake of the country, the people in it, and our economy in the future, we need to do what we need to do, especially over the next 6 days until I think the Trump administration will look and see what's going on, and based what's going on the ground, make a decision whether or not we're putting people back to work. Are we going to be flying again, or are we still going to be kind of, you know, sheltering in place, keeping our distance?
I think we have a new normal. We're going to have to be different, and we're going to have to operate differently. Yeah. Until there's a vaccine, you know, in Asia, many Asian countries, they wear masks, and they wear masks not to protect themselves. They wear masks, I read, to get rid of that stigma, because, you know, if a sick person is afraid to wear a mask, they don't want to be seen as a sick person. But if everybody wears a mask, then there's no stigma that everybody, you don't worry about it. And that's the way you can prevent the spread. Now, the problem is there's not enough masks right now. Another thing is there's not enough hand sanitizer. I mean, I can't find it in our grocery stores. You can't order it on Amazon. And so the problem is, I think there is a way to lift the shelter in place that we have that's very draconian, and to operate in a safer way. But there's no masks. There's a limited resources that would allow us to operate in a safer way. That's part of the problem too, right?
Right. So, don't underestimate the ability of good old-fashioned soap and water. Okay, so
yes.
Hand sanitizer is good. A light dose of hand sanitizer on your hands, depending on the type of hand sanitizer, you know, it can create more of a problem than a good problem.
Oh, really? Wait, why is that?
Skin. Well, the alcohol dries your skin out, which will cause it to crack. Once your skin cracks, it's no longer protective to you, and it gives a safe harbor for microbes to get down into. So you always want to use, try to use a hand sanitizer sparingly. More you want to use soap and water. And it does not matter whether it's warm water or cold water. It makes not a bit of difference. Just soap and water is fine. The vigorous hand rubbing is what breaks up viruses and bacteria. And then the soap actually causes it to slide off your skin. That's how it works. So you don't even need a antimicrobial soap. Just soap and water. Wash your hands vigorously for about 20 to 30 seconds, rinse, dry, and you're good. Hand sanitizer should be used sparingly throughout the day. Try to find one with a moisturizer. Only wear a mask if you're sick, because that stops droplets and airborne pathogens from getting to someone else.
Wait, but Trey, what about that idea of the people that are sick don't want to be looked at as pariahs, right? So they don't want to wear a mask and don't want anyone to think, oh, this person has coronavirus. Shouldn't we just all wear masks?
Well, everything is racist these days. So on the off chance that I sound racist here, I'm going to say it anyways. Asian culture is different than American culture. Okay, from what they eat to how they interact with each other, to the way they look at their leaders, to the way they act when they're sick. Okay, I think part of the problem with this China outbreak is they were, I guess you could, the word I would use maybe embarrassed by. They didn't want anyone to know that it was a failure on their part to contain a virus, which really the failure was to not say that they had a virus that was starting to become an epidemic within their country. They didn't want to ask for help, and that's part of their culture and how they are brought up. So, it's different in Asia and in China than it is here in the States.
But what does that have to do with the masks? What does it have to do? You don't think Americans are going to want to wear masks?
No, I don't think Americans mind wearing masks when they're sick.
Which is not when they're healthy.
Masks are at the door of every hospital when you walk into them with a sign that says, if you have a cough, a cold, a flu like symptoms, you know, whatever, please put a mask on. And people by and large put a mask on. I don't think that they really think about it when they're not walking into a healthcare facility to put a mask on, but I think that's something that we can educate, and I think our population is very capable of taking that information and using it.
What about temperature checks? Couldn't we have technology in airports and movie theaters, restaurants? Some guy just scans your face, right? And if you have a temperature, sorry, no, you're not entering here.
I see where that's a possibility, and we may end up going to that, especially after this. Is it feasible to do? Is it something that, the airlines are going to be able to do? You have buses, that bus people from coast to coast, planes that are not just flying within the States, but international flights. You need other countries to get on board with that. And then, you have the
I hear they do it across Asia. They do. They have these like face scanning things. They get your temperature before you enter a movie theater, like in Singapore and countries like that.
Right. Well, and that very well could be the case. But will the American people want that?
I don't think we want that, but also we don't want this like infectious disease, and we want to go back to work. We want the economy. I'm thinking like, how can we do the social distancing and open the economy up as soon as possible? Cause I think they're saying like 8 weeks or something like that. here in California, and then obviously Trump wants it to get back on track faster. But, you know, studying the Spanish flu, you know, when they did social distancing, it worked. And then when they loosened the social distancing, then the disease kind of picked up again. And I'm trying to figure out, like, how can we live with this new normal? You know, maybe face masks aren't that bad. Maybe temperature checks aren't that bad if we can open things back up and make some money again.
Right. Well, I think that we have to be open to short-term solutions initially for a long-term problem. So, you know, that very well could be, you know, especially, you know, if in order to open up the economy fully, you have to have buses running, you have to have flights running. So these people are packed in tight. You can pretty much social distance, you know, cut down on your carpooling, social distance in public, social distance at work. Don't shake hands, wash your hands.
Right.
Don't touch your face, cover your cough, all that stuff. But it's the mass transit and the way people do business, I think, is going to need to change. More using technologies like Messenger, emails, Skype, go-to meetings, whatever the case may be, right. More internet-based interactions than flights. You know, a lot of people love to fly to the next country to do their deal and sign and have that handshake, and that signifies something. That's going to be something that we have to look at, I think. That's going to be one of the biggest things is interactions internationally.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, after this is controlled, we got to keep the border shut. We got to keep immigration halted, or else it doesn't matter if we, you know, get rid of the disease here and then it's still, you know, ravaging other countries. Well, really quick, we could have a problem again here, right?
Right. Right. So another issue that we have, you know, is the immigration issue.
Yeah.
And like most Americans, I'm for legal immigration. 100%. I think there's a lot of people that could come here and do great things in our country. They should be allowed to come here.
But not right now. Not during an infectious disease outbreak, right?
No. Right. Not right now. but in the future, when we open up legal immigration, people should be coming here legally, and we should have a way to stop people from coming here illegally.
Right.
And, you know, like it or not, the border wall is one tool to do that.
Yeah.
And we have to have some comprehensive immigration reform once the wall has been built to take care of the immigration population that's here illegally.
You know, that reminds me, this stimulation, sorry to interrupt, but just a stimulus package that's being approved, you don't see the Republicans bargaining for wall funding, and yet the Democrats are asking for, like, Medicare for all, and it seems like the Democrats are really trying to politicize the stimulus package. Republicans would have a point to ask for border wall funding, wouldn't they?
So I think border wall funding, although in order to get past quickly, probably shouldn't be in it.
Right.
I'm one of those. I don't like things added into bills that don't belong in bills. But you can make a case that the border wall is a protection against not just illegals coming here, but prevention for the next pandemic.
Right. It makes more sense than Medicare for all.
Right. So even if it doesn't stop a pandemic from spreading into our country, it can slow it enough where we have a lot of reaction time that we can mount a good, solid defense against it without being taken off guard, which I believe is necessary moving forward.
Yes.
But, and this is probably a podcast for another time. Socialist medicine, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever, for all, whatever you want to call it, single-payer health care, does not work by and large. In any country that you see with a lot of death, I mean, Italy is the prime example of what can happen.
Yeah.
Decades ago, you could make an argument that Italy's health care was far greater than ours. That is not the case anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into healthcare and the reason why we're able to treat people the way we are able to treat them. Mm. And a lot of it has to do with private sector and these big healthcare corporations being independent from states and federal government. Mm. Of course, states and federal government oversee for regulations and to make sure that we're not just doing anything we want and, you know, running up a huge bill and, you know, medicating and treating patients the way we want to, whether they need it or not, right? There has to be some regulations. You know, you don't want infections and different stuff like that. So the federal government, the state governments do a really good job at oversight, and it's necessary. But the notion that a socialized medicine is more effective for healthcare than what we have right now is wrong.
And it's horrible using that as a kind of extorting the American people, kind of saying, look, you're not going to get this relief that you really need unless we get this experimental Medicare for All, which they're not going to get. I mean, no, you know, I don't know who exactly was calling for this. It was some wacko Democrat I saw who's running for Congress saying that people should strike and not go to work until Medicare for All is passed. And it's just such a mental way of thinking right now during a crisis to go political like that. You know, the border wall, that's proven in medical epidemics and this kind of thing. You know, secure the borders.
Right.
We know that's effective. But Medicare for All, I mean, we know it would be a disaster, but to, you know, the very least, it would be an experiment. And now is not the not the time for that. We're in a crisis. We got to, you know, do what works. And anyway, you see during times like this, what people really stand for. Right now, it looks like Democrats are trying to throw in a bunch of irrelevant things. And the Republicans are just trying to get this passed for the American people.
Right. And, you know, what bothers me the most about it is it was bipartisan till the 11th hour. And then all of a sudden, you know, the American people think they're going to get relief. A lot of anxieties are people are still in a little bit of a panic and have some anxiety, but it started to ease a little bit. And then the next morning you wake up and find out that it failed in the Senate because things were added in that shouldn't have been in there. And, you know, like you said, you see Democrats calling for, you know, people to stay out of work and to protest and to boycott and all this different stuff. And that's only going to hurt those people.
Yeah.
Likewise, on the Republican side, I've seen on social media sites where Republicans are saying, you know, and this is just, you know, general population, not necessarily anyone in Congress or in the government, but saying, you know, don't fill out your census form as a protest until they pass this. Well, that only hurts state and local governments if the people don't fill out their census. Mm. So, you know, you should not take drastic action that's going to cause long-term problems for a short-term goal. It's like what I always say, one of my sayings is don't make short-term decisions or don't make long-term decisions on short-term emotion. Mm. So, you know, if you make emotional decisions because you feel this emotion right now, it may hurt you in the long run. It's important to take a breath, sit back and think about things and use some critical thinking ability, which is one of the things that I really believe that over the past few decades with social media and the way we do things, that critical thinking ability has been lost. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you need to use common sense and some critical thinking ability and we'll get through it. You know, don't do anything drastic like quit your job or not show up or not fill out the census. That doesn't do anything for a flu pandemic other than make things worse later on once we do recover, and we will.
Now, I know you have limited time off. Are you able to go to the grocery store at all? I mean, or heard stories from your girlfriend or from friends. Is everything stocked at your grocery stores?
With the exceptions of like toilet paper, paper towels, which people seem to try to buy in bulk, everything seems to be there. There's been plenty of food. We've not run into crisis situations with when it comes to food. Now, they are getting the essentials like toilet paper and paper towels, and the stores have taken a more proactive measure in making sure that their people are limited to a pack of toilet paper, two rolls of toilet paper, or, you know, two rolls, you know, of paper towels, bread, you know, don't come in here and buy 10 loaves, you know, two loaves of bread is, some of the places that I've seen. So, these local retail stores have taken a more proactive approach in making sure one person doesn't come in and buy out an entire row of something and leaving it for everybody else, because we're this is a healthcare crisis, not a food crisis, not a water crisis.
Yeah.
It's important. You know, you're changing your routine, but don't change the way you shop. If people don't change the way they shop, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I agree. And it's weird that toilet paper is running out. Do you have any theory on that?
No clue.
It's so weird.
You know,
yeah.
My I had a grandmother that used to say, you know, don't be caught in a dirty pair of underwear. Always have on clean underwear. Right. That's just like an old school saying. And I think that's, it has to be something along that line. You know, somebody somewhere decided that they needed all these rolls of toilet paper because in a crisis, they didn't want to be without toilet paper. One person did it. A group of people saw them. They started doing it, and everybody started following suit is the only thing that I can think of, because I see no medical reason, no logistical reason for anyone to be doing that.
Yeah.
That's kind of been a shock to me.
It's so weird.
And this is not even an intestinal issue as far as, you know, medical goes. It's a respiratory issue, not intestinal. So, you would think that people would want, you know, diuretics, right? Or Mucinex or nasal sprays or, some sort of inhalers or whatever, like, but no, it's toilet paper and I don't get it.
Well, maybe some light will be shed on that as time goes on. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom and expertise on the podcast today, Sergeant Trey Bearclaw. Please come back on the podcast again soon and keep us updated about what you're seeing on the ground.
Will do. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Kingston Country. You've been listening to the Dan Kingston Podcast.